Good morning. So we've been studying in the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 5, we're eventually going to be in Matthew chapter 7 mainly today, but we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. We kind of, during the fall, looked through the Beatitudes one by one, through Matthew chapter 5 as Jesus is beginning this teaching. This is a teaching that we've talked about, that has really changed the world. It's a teaching that has changed human history and thought. Ideas that meekness and humility can be values weren't necessarily, but Jesus flipped them on their head, and he's changed the world through these words. The beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, through the Beatitudes, says the people that you wouldn't expect to be welcome are welcome. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are people who don't have it all together. He invites those into his kingdom. And then right after that, he says this statement to this group of people gathered there. It's a group of people kind of from all different places, some very religious possibly, some not religious at all. And he says to them, and you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. And the person listening to that probably would feel like you do today. Like, me? I don't have much biblical knowledge. I don't really have much power. I don't have much money. How am I supposed to be salt and light? This is a passage that we studied in depth about a year ago. We did a four-week series through it, so I'm not going to focus too much on this passage this morning. But walking away from this concept of being light of the world and salt of the earth, the question is how? How can we, as people who don't necessarily feel like we have it all together, how can we be salt and light? When Mandy and I started dating, I would have told you that I was a big movie fan, but slowly as we got to know each other and stuff, she made me realize I am not really a movie watcher. She kind of realized all the movies that I hadn't seen, and there were many, many that I hadn't. One of them was Forrest Gump. I still have never seen Forrest Gump. I know that's shocking and appalling to some people. I, before dating her, had never seen Indiana Jones movies except for the Alien one. Like, somehow I went to number four. I don't know how I went to number four and not any of the other ones. I've never seen any of the Rocky movies. I've never seen the Godfather movies. There's just tons. I know people are like, I'm never coming here again. I know. I'm very sorry. And one of the movies that I haven't seen, still haven't seen, is the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Even I know, I'm sorry. the preacher mentioned it last week, and I mean I don't really know what he's talking about. But my family probably about 5 years ago decided over the Christmas holidays they're going to watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy together, and they're going to watch the extended versions, the 4 hour, I think it's like 4.5, takes forever. And I just said, you know, I don't really want to do that. I think I'm all right. I'll go. I don't even know what I did for that time. It's like all my family's hanging out in there. I don't even know what I was doing in my time, but it was something better, I thought. And so finally on day three, as they're watching the third movie, I just kind of wandered into the room for the last 30 minutes of the third one. And as the credits started to roll, I said, I think I got the gist of it. You know, I got the gist. It's about a ring and a quest, and there's about 18 endings. I mean, like pretty much I got the gist of it. And they all looked like they wanted to kill me because they had just spent 12 hours of their lives watching the whole thing. Obviously, I don't know all there is to know about Lord of the Rings. I haven't read the books or watched the movies, but sometimes when you look at an ending, it can tell you a lot. How something ends can tell you a lot about what the concept is or what the movie or what the story is about. And so this morning, I want us to think about the end of the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to specifically focus in on one part. We actually looked at this passage about a year ago, but only one time, and I wanted to really get this because this helps us to understand the entirety of the Sermon on the Mount. Because as Jesus teaches in Matthew 5 through 7, there's some of these impossible ideals that he lays out. And you look at that and say, how is that even possible? How are we supposed to live that out? But he concludes by saying this, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice, this is Matthew 7, 24 through 27, is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the wind blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against this house, and it fell with a great crash. So this is at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, after Jesus has taught all of these things. And we know this story. If you've ever been to VBS, you know we have hand motions for it. We know that song, you know, the rains came down, the floods came up. But sometimes I think the things that we tell our children, the stories, remember in our Jonah series, the Jonah sermon, we kind of just leave that to the kids because we don't really want to deal with it ourselves. You know, like let the kids sing about it, but then we won't really think about it too much. This is saying something pretty profound. That Jesus, after he teaches these new ideals, this new way of living, this new concept of how to live in the world, he then says, now put it into practice. Make it happen in your life. It's kind of difficult because Jesus calls us to some radical stuff here in this sermon. Philip Yancey, in the book The Jesus I Never Knew, said this about reading in the Sermon on the Mount. When I read it, it felt like I had a low-grade depression. My cognitive dissonance kept me in a spiritual restlessness. If the Sermon on the Mount sets out God's standards of holiness, then I might as well resign from the start. How do we interpret the sayings of Jesus? How do we take them into our lives and apply them without getting a low-grade depression? And to be honest, I think a lot of people just kind of avoid these words and say, that's just too much. I can't ever actually live that out. I'm not even going to think about it. The Barna Group, who does research on Christians, they asked a large number of Christians from a broad spectrum of different parts of the country, what has following Jesus changed about your life? And one of the most disturbing surveys for American Jesus followers, the answer came back, not that much. They discovered that, generally speaking, faith has a limited effect on how people act. How did we get here? From following the most revolutionary man in human history, the one who started a movement that overcame Rome, the one who conquered death. How did we get to a point where it doesn't really change all that much about our lives? Dallas Willard says this way, non-discipleship, or people not becoming more like Jesus, is the elephant in the church. It's not the much discussed moral failures, financial abuses, or the amazing general similarity between Christians and non-Christians. These are only effects of the underlying problem. It is now understood to be part of the good news that one does not have to have a life that's a student of Jesus in order to be a Christian and receive forgiveness of sins. This gives a precise meaning to cheap grace that would be better described as costly faithlessness. Non-discipleship is the elephant in the church. The fact that many Christians would say that following Jesus hasn't really changed much in their lives. But to be followers of God and to be Christians, we have to take what Jesus says seriously. We have to understand how to put it into practice. But as I said, a lot of people don't. I think one reason is that it's just a little bit too hard. Some of the ideals that Jesus calls us to, it seems so countercultural. It seems so outside of the possibility of what we're able to do. I think part of that is we need to understand what Jesus is doing sometimes in his teaching. Jesus often is doing what's called prophetic hyperbole. Say that with me, prophetic hyperbole. Now, this is a teaching style that comes back from the Old Testament. The prophets in the Old Testament, they would come into a town and say a provocative message, you know, stop this and do that. And Jesus kind of continues in this same mold. He shows up to places. He doesn't do like a 60 days of power prayer festival. He usually shows up and maybe has 40 minutes or an hour, and he's teaching people what it means to follow him in this new life. Jesus says provocative things. And if we're honest, I don't think Jesus would be the preacher at our church for very long because he challenges people. Sometimes they want to throw him off a mountaintop. And Jesus comes into town and says these things with prophetic hyperbole and challenges the current thinking, challenges the people to think about how they can reorient their lives. Just a couple examples. In Luke chapter 18, 24 and 25, it says, Jesus looked at him and said, how hard is it for the rich to enter the kingdom of God? Indeed, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who's rich to enter the kingdom of God. You probably have heard some scholars say that there was a wall in Jerusalem that was like really narrow, but it could just barely fit a camel through, called the eye of the needle. And so that's what Jesus is referring to here. But I think that's a little bit stretching it, perhaps. I think that Jesus is saying to those of us who are rich, and most of us in here would be considered very rich by the world's standards. Don't let riches be your God. Don't let your wealth be the thing that stands in your way. Don't let your riches be the thing that you rely on. Riches matter a lot, and if you are relying on them, they're going to mess with your head. Later in Matthew 18, chapter 9, it says, "And if your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell." As I'm looking around in this room today, I don't see any eye patches. Luckily, no one brought any pirates with them this morning. But eyes are always a part of sin, and we're always sinners. I don't think I've ever sinned without the aid of my eyes before. You know, it usually kind of helps me. Maybe I just try to do it blind next time or something. But if we're taking this seriously, and we're taking it to be literal that we have to do this and we have to do something to respond. But Jesus, again, it's an example of prophetic hyperbole, that he's calling them to realize something, that the way your eyes are, the things that your eyes focus on, what they look at, it matters. Your eyes direct your life. The things that you're focusing on, the things that you're spending time looking at, those things direct your life. Again, it's an example of prophetic hyperbole. And so sometimes Jesus says things that just seem so big and so daunting and so challenging, it's just easier to go, well, I don't think Jesus knows that much. Again, Jesus knows a lot about getting me into heaven, but he doesn't really know the best way to live now. I'll wait until my deathbed, then I'll be like, Jesus, I'm good from here on. I'll put all my trust in you now, but I don't really want to actually think about what your words would cause me to do now. I don't want to think about the things that you would call me to do in my present situation. Sometimes it's hyperbole, it's these big, daunting ideas and tasks which should cause us to really consider. I mean, think of probably the most common example of hyperbole in your life. If maybe you skipped breakfast and lunch that day, and so you're sitting down to eat, and you tell your family, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. Yes, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. That's a 1,000-pound animal. Yeah, I don't think anybody, that horse is too cute. You wouldn't want to eat that horse. But you say that, you sit down and say, I'm so hungry, I could eat a horse. And I mean, even though you say that, you probably couldn't, no matter how many meals you've skipped. Like Chris Settlemyer tried to do a pancake challenge last week. His goal was to eat 30 pancakes at IHOP, because it's all you can eat pancake month. And he made it to 18, which is impressive. He's the current pancake record holder, and he's considering next year doing it just in, maybe without syrup, because that might help. But and no matter how hungry you are, there's just a certain amount of food you can't eat. I mean, no one is going to be able to sit down and eat a 1,000-pound horse. But there's truth behind that statement, though. There's truth that the person who says it is extremely hungry. They're obviously very hungry. So even as Jesus sometimes tells us these things that sound like such crazy ideals, there's truth in them that must be lived out. And there's truth in them that must be practiced. You know, there's 36 different, like, kind of scholarly interpretations of the Sermon on the Mount. 36 different ways to understand what it is and what it is that Jesus is calling us to. A couple examples. In medieval times, they just thought that this was the call for the clergy, so only the pastors and priests. So you guys could just come and tell me every week how I'm doing that or not doing that, I guess, and tell me what I'm doing wrong. So I don't really like that one that much. Another one, Martin Luther said that God's just trying to break us and make us feel bad about ourselves so that we'll realize that our only hope is in him. But what if we just took it seriously? What if Jesus meant what Jesus said? And even though it's going to be difficult, it's going to be hard, maybe this is what we're supposed to be, to look distinct in the world, to be salt and light. If we put this into practice, maybe we will be salt and light in our world. I think the really key part of this story that Jesus tells is Matthew 7, 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. I think that phrase, into practice, is a very important part of understanding this. It's not into perfection. It's not, you're going to make the right decision every single time from this moment on, but put it into practice. Remember, we had a baseball coach in high school who was about 50 years old, and everyone thought he lived at home with his mom still, but that was kind of beside the point. But he used to sit on the side and watch us all practicing, and he'd yell at us. He said, "Practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect." That was his like provocative statement, and he would yell it at us all the time. And I think that to some degree that's true. You know, oftentimes when it comes to following the Sermon on the Mount or following the words of Jesus, we just have these expectations. I'm a sinner. I can't do it. There's no way I can live up to that. So we just kind of settle for a standard that's a little bit lower and not try to put these things into practice, to not try to practice perfectly. We all know how important practice is. I've never juggled before, but I figured I'd try it today. See, I've never actually done it, but I've got some, actually bocce balls, but I guess they can work. And I watched a video on YouTube this week about it, and you know, actually, on this video it had a little comment that apparently there's a new thing called joggling, where people run and juggle at the same time. Someone who was joggling ran the Toronto Marathon in 2007 in 2 hours and 50 minutes. So how hard could it be to juggle? And I watched the video. I did some reading about juggling, so I figured I'd just go ahead and do it right now for you guys. All right, one more. I figured it'd be easier. I'll do it one more try. All right, one more. You know, it's not really working. Maybe I need to be a little afraid, so let me try to juggle some knives. All right, I'm not going to do that. Please make sure somebody remind me to take those off, because the Korean church is going to think we're doing something crazy in here with the knives up here on the... So someone make sure, remind Brian, take away knives. I mean, we know how important practice is. I mean, I might be able to learn, I'm not really that coordinated, but I might be able to learn how to juggle if I gave myself some time to learn how to do it. We know how important practice is, that someone like me who's not a juggler can put it into practice and slowly become a juggler. Maybe I could become a joggler someday if I really put it into practice. We know how much practice can help. We know how much it can change us. And when we see the words of Jesus, that are sometimes these daunting tasks, that these hyperboles that Jesus says, this is what you're supposed to live into. Maybe as we learn to live into them, we'll understand a deeper relationship with God. And so when Jesus says something like, don't even worry about adultery, worry about lust. And as you're reading, you're like, dude, Jesus, I'm a guy. Like, I lust without even a picture. I mean, it just happens. That you slowly learn how to deal with lust in your life, that as you put it into practice, maybe you can practice it 9 times out of 10, you're able to work on lust and make it better. Then the next time you do it, 49 times out of 50, then 99 times out of 100, then 99 times out of 1,000, and eventually you'll realize that your heart is being remade. That eventually you'll realize that it's much better to have lasting moments of intimacy with people than it is for just a few seconds of fake reality. But slowly, over time, your heart can be remade. That as you put the words of Jesus that sound so daunting and so strange and unfamiliar, as you put them into practice, your heart can be remade. Jesus says this is the kind of life that stands. We sing that song, the rains came down and the floods came up and the house on the rock stood firm. This is the kind of life that stands. A life that stands in the midst of a storm. And Scripture says trouble is coming. Storms are going to come in your life. Storms are going to come in your marriage. Storms are going to come in your relationships. What's the kind of life that can stand? What's the kind of life that can make it through a storm? Jesus says, put this into practice and you will see the kind of life that can stand. The kind of life that will last forever. There's a parable that you're probably familiar with in Matthew chapter 25 where Jesus tells a story about a guy who gives a certain amount of talents or bags of gold to some people, and he gives different amounts to different people. And when the people, the first who come back, they've come back and they've doubled what they got. And the master says to them, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. And notice what that statement is. Well done. Not well thought, or well said, or you had good intentions. It's well done. The faithful servants, they put these things into practice. It's well done. When you put into practice using your talents, when you put into practice this kind of life, you'll have a life that can last forever. A heart that can be remade. It isn't about its intentions, it's about action. I heard a story a couple weeks ago, Martin Luther King Day. It just happened, an amazing story about George Raveling, who was a longtime coach at the college level and did a little NBA coaching too. And he was around when Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. He ended up going into town to Washington, D.C. that day. And George Raveling was a really tall basketball player at Villanova at that time. And so they saw him, and they were having a lot more people coming to this celebration day than they were expecting. And so he saw this really tall guy and said, hey, you want to run security for us? And so he got to be on the stage while Martin Luther King and other influential leaders of the civil rights movement gave these amazing speeches about moving America in a different direction. And so he got to stand up there while all these people were doing, he actually stood actually looking out the other direction away from Dr. King and the people. And so he was standing there, and after Dr. King finished his speech, he noticed that Dr. King had left his speech behind, and he said, hey, you want to take that with you? And Dr. King said, no, you can keep it, you can have it. So George Raveling, from that day on, has had the words on the page of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And he still keeps it hung up in his office or in his house. He's showed it to countless players that he's coached. You know what's so powerful about those words? People say that it's just priceless. You can't even really put a price on that. And he's not willing to sell it, but you can't put a price on it. If anyone ever wants to mount my sermon onto something, you guys are welcome to do that. But on this, it's just priceless. And it's not even necessarily because of the words that are on the page. At the end of the speech, the I Have a Dream most famous part, it's actually very different than what's written on the page. Dr. King just kind of went off on his own tangent. It was actually a very good one, so he did a good job. But it's not even because of the words on the page that these things are priceless, that they're so significant. It's not even the words, as eloquent as they were spoken by Martin Luther King. It's the actions that followed. It's the actions of the civil rights movement that ended up moving us more in a direction of equality. It's the actions that people actually put on these words, not because of the words themselves or the words on the page. It's because people put these words on in action. And they became salt and light to change our world, to move our world in a direction. And again, it's not fully there yet, but these words are priceless, not because of the words themselves, but because of the actions that followed. We must be people of action who decide to put the words of Jesus into action in our lives, to become salt and light in our world. And again, sometimes the words are going to be so daunting and so big, I don't know how I can possibly do that. But as we live into the hyperbole that Jesus calls us to, we can see that our hearts are being remade. And as I'm going to say again and again, maybe we'll realize that this is the best way that we can live. If you would like to connect your life more deeply with Jesus, if you would like to follow a way to learn more about how to be a disciple of his, I'll be down front, and Bill Rogue, one of our elders, will be here with me. We would love to pray with you or connect your life to our church or talk about baptism and following Jesus in that first step or whatever it is. But I hope no matter where you are on your journey of faith, you'll take seriously the words of Jesus, that you'll learn how to live into them more and more, that you'll learn that maybe, just maybe, it's the best way to live and your heart can be remade. Let's stand and worship together.